Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks. Well, I'm joined today by Amber Bucher. I've been a fan of her work for a long time. She developed the FinX Tech Connect platform and awards program for Bank Director, where she interviewed banks and technology companies to write research reports and in-depth editorial profiles on over 300 fintechs, a series of articles on innovative banks, and feature stories for Bank Director magazine. Now, Amber is Director of Insights for the Alloy Labs Alliance, a consortium of innovative banks that work together to test and adopt new ideas, and where we actually work together in our day jobs. So she recently published a research report titled Why Women Innovate: Three Common Experiences That Create Remarkable Leaders. It's exploring the correlation between the experiences of women leaders and innovation. So joining Amber today are two of the leaders profiled in that report. Mary Ann Scully is a lifelong banker with more than 40 years of executive experience in the industry. She's CEO of Howard Bank, a $2.5 billion bank based in Baltimore that boasts one of the top five women-led teams in the nation, along with Casey Christopher, who's the Chief Empowerment Officer of Quantic Bank in New York, where she leads efforts focused on shared experiences, impactful opportunities, co-creation, and positive energy. She was part of the innovative team at Center State Bank prior to joining Quantic. Well, welcome to all of you. But Amber, I'll start with you. Why did you write this report?
Well, like all of the best projects, it started from a cryptic message on Slack. I think it was my second day at the
Let me guess, it's from Jason.
Right? Yes, right. If you've worked with Jason, you've been on the receiving end of many a cryptic message. But it was a great message actually to get, because I could tell he was excited and he said, "We're really over-indexed on women." And I was like, whoa, hold the phone. Who is we? What do you mean? And he was pointing out that Alloy Labs Alliance, which is our consortium of innovative banks, is led by women at what he thought was a really, you know, astronomical rate compared to our industry. And when I did some digging, it turns out he was right. The banks that are members of Alloy Labs are run by female CEOs at twice the rate of the Fortune 500. So there's definitely a correlation there. And we decided to dig deeper and figure out what was underlying that correlation. Were innovative banks more likely to promote women into the leadership, or did banks become more innovative when women rose to the leadership ranks within them?
Well, and as you start to dig into that, were there any data that surprised you?
What surprised me, I think we're all to the point where we understand like diversity has business benefits, right? Diversity has been proven to be linked to increased performance revenue. But what surprised me was the amount of research that had been done that correlated specifically gender diversity and specifically with performance that was the result of innovation. So one of the footnotes that I have in the report cites like a half dozen different of the just best pieces that I found that said, not only is gender diversity important for performance, it's performance specifically innovation and developing new products and seeing new opportunities is what they're really special at. So that was a bit of a surprise.
Well, and clearly that's where the Alloy Labs Alliance is focused around all of that. So, I mean, your research and your report reveal that there are really three major areas where women's experiences differ significantly. And I'm sure you'll talk about this. First of all, it's about the experiences. It's not about the innate things of X and Y chromosomes, right? It's about how life experiences impact their ability to lead transformationally. And you said three things: career paths, life experiences, and the need to rely on transformational leadership to combat bias. So Marianne, maybe I'll start with you. You've had what you called both traditional and non-traditional career path. You've been in client-centric roles, managing business lines and business development. You've had experience in more strategic functions like M&A and finance. I mean, how have those experiences combined to help you be more innovative, or as Amber says, a transformational leader?
I think that my experiences have hopefully built on some inherent innovative traits, but they've also been all about experiences that forced me to be innovative. So, you know, I joined banking a long time ago and naively joined within 10 years of two of the most significant pieces of EEOC legislation having been passed. And so naively went into my first management training job thinking, the government's taking care of it for me. I'm not going to have any barriers. And when I was asked in one of my first interviews, you know, what birth control method I was using, I understood that that was not necessarily the case. And so I think from the very beginning, I was forced to be innovative in the sense of wanting to be a banker, wanting to make that sort of impact on my community. And for me, that was always part of why I wanted to be a banker, wanting to be well-grounded in the professional aspects of the business. And so I wanted the career, but at the same time had to find a way to navigate through a series of barriers that for the most part really were subconscious. You know, I went to work initially for a bank that was truly viewed as one of the more welcoming and embracing of professional women. And immediately went into a very traditional role and one that still is frequently populated mostly by women, and that was a retail bank branching role, even though when I joined the bank, I said I wanted to work with businesses, mainly small and medium-sized businesses, but was told, again, the only opportunity for a woman without a master's degree was in the branches, but had people, because of that innovation I saw on the part of some of my male colleagues who said, you should try to make a change as quickly as you can. So then went into what I term a traditional, now retrospectively traditional role of being a commercial banker, and initially was involved in national treasury management, national lending, and international lending. And in retrospect, believe that I was probably more easily successful in those functions because internally I was fighting against fewer of my male colleagues. I wasn't in a traditional middle market role. I was one of the corporate bankers, and enjoyed it enormously, learned a lot, focused mostly on what can the bank do for my clients? How can I understand my client's business? And then because of some organizational changes at that bank, because of some personal preferences on my part, as I said to a new president, I know more people in Amsterdam and Santiago than I know in Baltimore, and that's not what I want the rest of my life to be like, was asked to go into an M&A role and then to head up a strategic planning group. And that's a very non-traditional role inside a bank. It is.
And I want to come back to that because you said some interesting things in the report about how those more strategic roles really challenge you in different ways. But yeah, Casey, I want to bring you in on this conversation too, because you have a long history also of diverse roles in multiple banks of different sizes. And Quantic Bank has a great mantra that we like and repeat often, progress over perfection.
Progress, not perfection. Which I know, progress, not perfection.
Not perfection.
Not over, yep.
So we just had a handful of heart attacks out there, people running the audit committee and the loan books. But I know that scares a lot of traditional bankers, but what do you think it is about your career path that has helped you embrace this philosophy and lead it within Quantic?
Yes. So I've had a really interesting path. And one of that is I was in correspondent banking. That's the majority of my career. And I started in correspondent banking in Florida in 2007. So, I mean, you can't really think of a worse time to start in banking than 2007. And what ended up happening is that I had a front row seat to everything that was going on in Florida at the time. And since I was a correspondent banker, I had hundreds of bank customers at the time. And I think my max was 385 Florida community banks. And then it went down to about 90 when I left Florida. So what I got to see was not only worst practices, but best practices too. So while I spent the majority of my career at Center State Bank down in Florida, I really spent time with hundreds of banks in the Southeast and then moving up to the Northeast to understand what was the best way to do things. And I was really fortunate to have Quantic be a customer of mine and was able to move over there. And something that really struck me, Steve Schnall, our CEO, he was one of the only bankers in my 18 years of working in banking that really seemed to understand and see banking the way I did. And he was quite a bit of an outsider. He's a mortgage guy that bought a bank. And I really saw something innovative and really interesting on how he was looking at things. And we, a group of us, were out to dinner one night. And I was like, this, he is saying exactly what I'm thinking. And because nobody else was saying it before, I thought I was the only one and that maybe banking couldn't be that way. But he opened this door.
What was it that he said that was so jarring for you in a good way?
Yeah. I mean, we're both crypto enthusiasts. So talking about cryptocurrency, why isn't there an intersection of banking and crypto? And why do we have to offer all these products that might not be best for our customers in our community? They just don't really fit. How can we do better to really strategically align our products, both our deposit side and our lending side, for our community? And that was a huge piece that we're a CDFI, a community development financial institution. So we follow a little bit different guidelines on the mortgage side. So that was really interesting to me too, that we were able to lend non-QM as well.
Well, and that brings us right back to where Marianne left off, which is you talked in the report about those more strategic roles in M&A and finance that really helped you understand the business. And you talked about the need to really understand the nuts and bolts of the business from the inside to be able to innovate. You know, talk a little bit more about that.
Well, I think Casey's alluding to that as well. I mean, what she was doing when she was working with correspondents was looking at other banks. So you're not looking at different industries. You're looking at your own industry. You know, whether you do it from the outside in or from the inside out, you're looking at your own industry. And it's a challenging industry. I mean, it's because of deregulation, it's become increasingly challenging. You look at our profit margins, you look at our leverage ratios, you look at the level of regulations that we comply with, and people who haven't ever been in the business but who are financially astute look at those numbers and say, I don't know how you do this. And so you are forced, when you understand your own business and you see it changing constantly and rapidly, but if you are committed to the business and the impact it can have on others, it forces you to say, what can I do differently? And as Casey said, one of the great things about M&A and strategic planning is it forces you to look at others in your industry and say, what are they doing? I mean, you lose any sort of arrogance that you have that we know the best way. We don't know the best way, and to the progress, not perfection, maybe there is no one best way. But that sort of role just forces you to constantly be thinking about what could I do differently in order to maximize the results and maximize the impact.
And that's, you know, that's just a way of thinking, right? So I think we talk about it in terms of roles. That's what kind of bubbled up in the report. Was it was very easy to see, like, okay, a lot of the female CEOs that are out there are COO or CFO, and they've got this kind of defined path. But really, it's not so much about the role as it is just having a broader perspective on the industry. And so the first kind of area of the report that talks about women's career paths, the kind of end kind of tactical maybe suggestion for a bank would be create a program that cycles women, but can, you know, maybe everyone in and out through different roles and gives them a turn to take on some of these roles that they wouldn't take on, you know, otherwise possibly. I mentioned Lori Still in the report, who has a very high women majority board and has encouraged a lot of women to take on different roles. And she said, like, you have to push people out of their comfort zone. I think that's, you know, an area where it's not about the role, it's about the perspective. And you can create programs that in some respect or another are tailored to give people an opportunity to get different perspectives about our business.
But I think it needs to be organic, Amber. I mean, I think that the best thing you can do for women, and we talked about this when we talked about our Women in Leadership program, is it's our job as leaders to provide the platform and to provide the atmosphere and the environment in which they can thrive. So you don't necessarily want to say the way they did 100 years ago in management training programs, you're going to spend 6 months here and a year here and then 2 years here. You want women to develop the confidence that allows them to take risks. And one of the things that I found in leading women is that is more difficult for women than it is for men, in part because women get hung up, back to Casey, on the perfection piece of things. And men don't get hung up on that. You know, I mean, a man will always tell you he's qualified for a job, whether he is or not. And a woman will always doubt whether she's qualified, no matter how much experience she's had. So we need to create that environment where women are empowered to take risks and are even told, I explicitly tell people, if you never fail, you're never going to be as successful as you could be.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Marianne, I think that really connects the dots for me because that's exactly the kind of language we use as we help organizations try to be more innovative, right? If we're not taking enough risk, we're not trying hard enough. If we're just exploring the things that we already know. And it makes me think of something else you've talked about, Casey, which is this whole idea of imposter syndrome.
Absolutely. Imposter syndrome is a real thing. I read about it often. I blog about it on LinkedIn. In September 2020, when my CEO and at the time our CIO came to me and let me know that I was going to be promoted and my new role, my new position was going to be Chief Empowerment Officer at the bank, and still sitting across from them in the Zoom, I still thought to myself, I'm not good enough to be this role. How could they have rolled this out to me? And the role was created specifically for me and my talents, and I still really couldn't understand. But I'm very aware of imposter syndrome, and I know how to banish it from my head. And I coach a lot of our employees. Going back to what Marianne said about men raising their hands for roles that maybe they are slightly qualified for, and women having to be 100%. There's also a piece, a confidence journal, that a workaround that I built in my late 20s, where I was often the only woman in the boardroom or the room, and we'd be going around making a decision, and I would often be the only one that didn't agree with the decision, but I didn't have the confidence at the time to speak up. So what I did is I wrote it in a journal, and I wrote what I thought, and then the decision we got to. And then lo and behold, oftentimes, perhaps the decision wasn't the decision that was the best for the organization. And I go back to my confidence journal and say, man, perhaps if we had gone with what I suggested, we might not be in the situation we are right now. So what I needed to do was constantly see data that perhaps my ideas were genuine and authentic. And that made me much more comfortable to sit at that table when I was the only one that thought this wasn't a good idea and say, I really do not believe we should be doing this. And I had that data in front of me. And I still have a confidence journal that I kind of jot down in. But it was a workaround for me to understand how to be more confident with my own voice.
Well, and it's not to say that men don't suffer from imposter syndrome either. One of the things I've been happy to see is that this has been a topic of conversation in the startup community. And and there's an enormous pressure on people to, you know everything about everything, and we don't. But I point super well taken that we don't generally lack for confidence on my side of the fence.
The show is brought to you by Privacy. Start the new year off right by making your digital life more secure. Privacy lets you buy things online using virtual cards instead of having to expose your real card number, protecting your identity and bank information on the internet. Right now, new customers will automatically get $5 to spend on their first purchase. Go to privacy.com/breakingbanks to sign up now. With Privacy, you can control your subscriptions and recurring payments to make sure you're never accidentally billed twice or upgraded to another service without your consent. Save time with a Chrome or Firefox extension fill out all of your virtual card information with just one click. But what I like best is the card sharing feature. You can easily and safely send a friend, family member, or coworker a Privacy virtual card with just an email, and Privacy will handle the rest. It's also great for small business owners to safely share expenses with a team. Head to privacy.com/breakingbanks and sign up for an account. New customers will automatically get $5 to spend on your first purchase. Go to privacy.com/breakingbanks and sign up now.
Well, Amber, let's talk about the other aspects that you found in your research, life experiences and the need to rely on transformational leadership to combat bias.
Yeah, so I think the thing that is interesting about these, all of the areas, but these two in particular, is that you look at these and you think, well, that's, you know, I can't just put in a program. I can't just put in a program to cycle people through different roles like I can with number one. Number two and three seem a lot harder and they seem a lot less approachable because they have to deal with gender roles and, you know, cognitive dissonance and like all of these big societal ills that seem really impossible to tackle. But the fact is, when you break these experiences down into what they translate to from a business perspective, you can actually learn a lot from them and you can use these as screening tools. So you're not screening for traits. We're not saying, oh, women are better communicators. And so we're going to hire women or look for people that like score really highly on communication. Like you can look at these as experiences that when you talk to someone, when they're sitting in front of you and you're hiring or promoting someone, you know, are they parents? Have they dealt with a screaming 5-year-old in the grocery store? And how did they do that? You can look at these as a way to look at the experiences that someone might have that will equip them to solve business problems in a way that is maybe a little bit different because it's outside of a business context. It teaches us to look at a whole person, I guess. And some of these, you know, do create opportunities for creating programs and rules that are quite replicable. So when we think about bias, we can think about different ways that we can bring in training, you know, to look at how we identify bias and whether we even can. I mean, just knowing that these other areas are out there, it's really hard to think of a single program or thing that you can do to solve for them, if you will. But the fact of the matter is we can use these as just lenses to look at our world and start to examine how we operate in the day-to-day kind of one step at a time.
Well, Marianne, you talked about your women in leadership group. Are you looking at things outside of the bank, career path and experience? Are you looking at life experience and other things to help build that diversity?
Well, I think what we're trying to do is to acknowledge the whole person when we build that diversity. So I wouldn't say that we're specifically looking for another set of life experiences, but I use as an example a recent board appointment that we made. And we are big believers in diversity in its broadest sense. And I think that's the advantage of having women at its heart is diversity is about having a different perspective. It's about having somebody in the room who has not had the same life experiences as others, doesn't come at things from the same perspective because of the fact that they're a different gender or a different race. But at the heart, what you're trying to do is to build different perspectives. So, and we all have a lot of work to do in those areas, as committed as we might be. And so we knew that we wanted to bring some additional diversity to our board. And the person that we were fortunate enough to convince to accept our nomination is a woman who was the adjutant general of the National Guard in Maryland. And somebody approached me and asked me if we were looking for military experience when we tried to fill this role. And I said, no, we were looking for different experiences. And to be quite candid, I'm not sure that military would have risen to the top of the list if we had created a list. But what we've learned internally, and this is through a male colleague on our executive team, is that military experience, especially military leadership, provides you with a unique set of perspectives in terms of a commitment to leadership, first of all. your people aren't just something that's going to help you get your job done. Your job is to develop them. And that's a very not so subtle distinction in terms of how people view leadership. But also, you're trained to deal with very fluid situations, very frightening situations, very dynamic situations. And in an industry that's tough to begin with and getting tougher every day, what more could we want? So I think that we're just constantly looking for a whole person who certainly can bring some of the technical skills we need. Banking is a technical profession, but brings a different set of life experiences that will give us that true fundamental diversity in a boardroom or in a leadership team.
Well, and again, this connects the dots for me very well, because even though I'm a kind of a poster child for the lack of the general diversity in our industry, I'm a big proponent of diversity, not just because it's the right thing to do and all of that, because it's the right business thing to do, right? If we have diverse leadership teams that reflect our diverse employee base, that reflect our customer base, and understand those different experiences that we might not have, that help us design better products and services and customer experiences around that. So, I mean, that makes complete sense to me. Now, Casey, how are you thinking about this at Quantic Bank, and particularly the things that are maybe outside of not just rotation and career path?
Sure. So, I mean, first, cognitive diversity is important, period. And in the report, it says companies in the top tier for gender diversity were 25% more likely to experience above average profitability than companies in the bottom tier. That's a big difference. 25% is something significant to think about. We believe that innovation is reimagining and re-engineering things. And I consider myself kind of the chief problem solver. I consider Steve, our CEO, the chief problem solver as well. So it's important that with that cognitive diversity, that we're also curating and encouraging listening and engagement and greater communication.
When Casey and I talked for the report, she was telling me this story about, you know, she started at Quantic in the pandemic, and it was all about, we were talking about listening to your employees. And she was telling me about a friend of hers who had just wanted to tear a wall down, and she just came out and said it.
Yeah. And it, I mean, you can make little changes. And we did. I did have a neighbor that demolished.
I just wondered if that's where you were going.
Yeah. I don't know where I was going. It's getting okay. Late on a Friday. I'm like, yeah. Me and Pinot Grigio. What's in between me and Pinot Grigio? No, it's about being creative and listening. And one of the things, I had an employee that I did a one-on-one coffee Zoom with, and she was rubbing her eyes the entire time. And I said, you know, is there anything we can do for you? Really tired? What's going on? And she let me know that she was doing a lot of data entry and that she only had the one laptop monitor. And we were able to immediately ship her two monitors. So she had, her eyes weren't hurting. And sometimes it's just that careful listening and viewing and understanding how you can make your employees' lives better. Just a small tweak like that.
Well, Amber, you also have some conclusions, some bold conclusions in the report. Let's talk about that. What do organizations need to do to improve their capacity for transformation and being able to leverage diversity as a way to do that?
Yeah, we broke it down into four phases of progress. So commit, invest, act, adjust. And the first one is commit. You need to have a clear tone from the top that says, we're going to do this thing. We're going to roll up our sleeves and make gender diversity and diversity of all types, frankly, a priority. What gets dictated from the top gets measured, and that's definitely the first step. And we've seen a lot of the really large banks taking big steps, committing to, you know, diversity goals or closing the pay equity gap. They're making really big public proclamations, and I think that's really inspiring and something to look up to. But I think that there are degrees of that you can do that fit your bank, but that still make a clear statement that this is going to be a priority for you. It's really important to commit right off the bat, because the next step doesn't work if you don't do that. So the next step is investing. If you've decided that this is a priority to increase performance through increasing diversity, you need to have a lot of people that are responsible for that. You can't just put this all on your HR director and say, go forth and make us diverse, right? Casey, you look, yeah, what's up?
Well, we, in May of 2020, very early on, we decided that we were going to pivot to remote workforce full time. So we didn't know when we were going to have folks back into the bank. And we thought that at this point, this gave us an opportunity to be more diverse and to recruit from all over the United States. So at the time, we had employees living in three states in the tri-state area here in New York. And I'm proud to say that we're at 23 states right now, which has really improved not only our diversity of employees, but it's also really helped me as a leader, because I have so much different perspective. I mean, when I'm doing certain engagement activities, I have to understand that I've got California, I've got different time zones that we need to utilize. And I also have different interests, and we have folks with children that during certain times are not able to join us for engagement activities, and others are. So while it has increased, been beneficial for our bottom line, it's also made our leadership stronger.
Yeah, so you have HR that comes in on the one hand to hire all that diversity, right, across all of those different states. But then, you know, everyone is dealing with that throughout the organization. So you have to really put mandates on even, you know, not just your executive team, but your middle management that says, this is important. We are grading you on this. This is not just about running the bank, but about changing the bank is something that I think we like to talk about in our innovation circles. JP and I, it's not just about running it, but what did you do to actually change the bank? And so that, you know, everyone, you just have to have a broader base of responsibility for this. And that's what we mean by invest. You have to invest not just money, you know, in terms of like making bold proclamations or launching initiatives or women's groups or things like that. There is some, you know, some money is required, don't get me wrong. But the bigger thing that you have to do is really invest in your people's time and making it clear that you do want them investing their time in this, and they will be, you know, graded on that, so to speak. The third thing that you can do is to actually act, right? This is the where the rubber meets the road in a lot of ways. So this is programs, but it's also policies, and it's also personal steps that you can take to really change your organization. So I think, you know, it's a no-brainer, like let's have equitable parental leave for both sexes that is encouraged for both sexes to actually take that leave. Like that is a solid program that I think everyone kind of understands levels the playing field. But there are things that you can and should be doing personally to change the way that you create opportunities for equity as a leader. And these are harder to come to terms with. They're honestly a little harder to identify. The one that is, I think, the easiest for a lot of people to think about is dinners, right? So boozy late night dinners where a lot of business gets done. Those are really tricky waters for anyone to navigate, but particularly for women to navigate, right? So a really easy thing that you can do is say that you only meet with, you know, you only do business meals during the daytime. So breakfast or lunch. And that, you know, takes a lot of really hard waters to navigate, like right off the table. So acting is the third one. And then the fourth thing that you can do and must do, honestly, to be successful is adjust. So diversity initiatives are not like a set it and forget it thing. You have to constantly keep measuring it and adjusting and taking the temperature of the people in your organization. I'm sure, Casey, if you did it, you know, if you were doing a new initiative, you would constantly be checking in with people asking, you know, what's changed? How are you feeling? Like, what's the atmosphere like lately? You know, how do you attribute it to this or that, you know, change being made? You always have to be listening and you always have to be adjusting. And I think bankers today more than ever just always have to have their ear to the ground.
Well, Amber, one of the other things that's come up kind of after the report was published, I know you've been dealing with is, well, we don't have anything to worry about. We're a meritocracy. So we don't care about your gender or any other form of diversity. Just do a great job and you're going to do well here. Well, why is that not the answer?
I'm happy to let anyone else jump in.
Well, I think Chief Empowerment Officer is a great example of that. I mean, I'm the only Chief Empowerment Officer that I'm aware of in community banking. And that is because we had a need for employee empowerment engagement in during a pandemic, during a remote workforce. And then I had the skills and the leadership to bring that forward to our that our employees. So I think that you have to think outside the box. You have to be able to pivot. I mean, certainly I don't think if we were sitting here in 2019 and I was at Quantic, I don't know that there would be a need for all of the skills that I'm using right now. So I think you have to be nimble, you have to be flexible, and you have to really look to the person, not the role in the org chart that you're trying to fill.
Well, so when it comes to, you know, to meritocracy, I think this idea that talent just naturally bubbles up is really, it's really good that you think that that's how it works. But unfortunately, bias is hidden. We don't know when we're doing it. And if we're not looking out for it, it's going to sneak up from under us. And this goes back to something that Marianne and I talked a lot about, which is just intentionality. When I first called her, I actually, one of the things that prompted me to reach out, I knew Marianne before, but I reached out because I noticed that three out of five of their SVP promotions at Howard Bank this last year were women. And I said, was this intentional? And I'll let you answer that, Marianne.
Well, it's part of the commitment, right? And the commitment needs to be long-term. And I think that's one of the ways that you address this meritocracy issue. But when I've been asked by some of my, you know, perhaps less open-minded colleagues at other financial institutions, well, how have you done this? You know, we won a pretty prestigious American Banker Award this year where it's about women teams, senior women teams. And that was much more exciting for me and for us to be recognized in that way than to have, you know, the CEO recognized, because it really said something about, look at these areas of the company, significant areas of the company that are managed by women. But that's something that started a long time ago. So it's part of your commitment is the intentionality. None of this happens by accident. You have to be intentional about it. And I think the problem with meritocracy, I mean, you know, any of us that have read books about, you know, the deeply troubling inequality that we have in the country today would acknowledge that this element of meritocracy has actually been one of the contributing factors. You know, anybody can do X, Y, Z. And we have to acknowledge that anybody can't do that. I mean, that there are people who literally are now privileged in terms of the access that they've had to a different education, different information systems, digital access. And so to simply assume that everybody starts from the same point in time and therefore it's your merits that cause you to advance is just a data fallacy. It's not true. People aren't starting from the same point. The other thing that I think meritocracy alone has embedded in it as a problem is, how do you define meritocracy? What are the metrics that you're using to define that? And there need to be intangibles as well as tangibles that are incorporated in that. But it's a long-term commitment. You know, are you going to give somebody an executive position that might not today be qualified for? Probably not. Probably not good for the shareholders, probably not good for that individual. But you better be preparing today for the fact that you need to have that diversity in your executive team. So it's about commitment, it's about communication, it's about some non-negotiables. If having diversity of thought is important, then it's not something that we can keep excusing ourselves for not having.
Yeah, Marianne, I think that brings up a quote that we say around Alloy a lot. And I don't know if this has always been the case, but certainly over the last few months, we've been saying a lot, JP says this a lot, that when you're accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression. And I think it's really important to honor that and like respect the truth of that. Like DEI initiatives are going to feel really uncomfortable for a lot of people. And I'll just say it, like men, a lot of men that I know are feeling really attacked and blamed right now. And like, we need to understand that when we're asking people to take a look at bias and, you know, how are you inviting people to dinner and like all of these things, it's a lot, and it's a lot to unpack for everyone. And so I just encourage folks, you know, to, as JP was saying earlier, this is not about altruism or, you know, you doing your part to make the world better for everyone. I hope that's why you would want to increase diversity, but really, at the end of the day, it's about having the diversity of thoughts and viewpoint and experience that you need to innovate and to get to new places in your business. And it really is a business imperative. So I think that's what the hope is that we'll all do this to get better together.
Well, I agree. And the dots are just connected throughout this entire conversation, as I keep commenting on, and as Marianne's last comments, the level of intentionality. And it's the same thing, right? If you want to innovate, you want to bring new ideas to market, you have to be intentional about it. The meritocracy doesn't work in innovation either. Oh, don't worry. If you have good ideas, they'll make their way to the top. No, they don't, right? You've got to work them and test them and sell them internally. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. And thanks, Casey and Marianne and Amber, all for being here. But Amber, I'll give you the last word for folks who are interested in more. How can they download this report, and where can they find it?
Yeah, we'd love for you guys to go to alloylabs.com/research to download the report, alloylabs.com/research. And I will say too, I would love to have folks reach out to me if you have feedback, thoughts, questions. I was just talking with a banker yesterday about the report, and she pointed out something to me about it that really struck me. And I'm excited that we get to use that feedback that we're getting on the report now to drive our next initiative, which is a women in leadership benchmark that we're developing within the Alloy Labs with our members. We had a great number of them that indicated that they wanted to roll up their sleeves and figure out how to measure their pipelines and their processes. And so we're really excited to begin that work. And so, yeah, reach out to me, amber@alloylabs.com. If you want to shout at me or ask me a question, open to any and all feedback that'll help drive that next step for us all.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.